Campus FM presents a talk organized by Malta Cafe Scientifique entitled Sex and the City. This talk is delivered by Professor Savona Ventura.
Hello and welcome to Malta Cafe Scientifique. It's great to see you all here. I mean, this is definitely the biggest turnout we've had by a teeny bit. And I suspect it's because of this word, sex. And I'll blame Professor Savona Ventura for that. It was his suggestion, not mine. I just encouraged it. So what is Malta Cafe Scientifique? What is this whole idea? We're here to try and organize scientific talks, right? And science, it's usually thought of as hard and as unpopular and all of these sort of things. How do you understand science? Well, our aim is to get the scientists outside of the Ivory Tower University and into a place which you usually do not expect to find a scientist. In our case, it's Inspirations Cafe. This is a worldwide branch of science cafes. There's some in Canada, the US, there's even in Japan. There's more than one in Uganda, which I think is amazing. And that is what we are trying to do. We are trying to get the public and scientists to talk and discuss what I consider, at least, something which is very interesting, science. Our events in Malta run, first we'll have 30, 45 minute talk. It's meant for everyone. And after that we'll have a short 10 or 15 minute break. And we'll be serving nibbles and a glass of wine or soft drinks. And after that then, I think it comes to the exciting part of the evening, which is that, well, anyone who wants to ask a question can just raise their hand and ask Professor Savona, as long as it's on the night's topic, within reason, especially considering the night's topic. It's sex and the city, Malta-style sexuality. Now, I really like that, you know. It's very popular, right? You've got Sex and the City. I've actually watched the first movie. My girlfriend forced me to do that. And she's in the audience, so I'm just enjoying embarrassing her at the moment. And when she told me that Professor Savona Ventura wanted to give a talk, that's what she told me. Then I learned that And then I emailed him and he accepted. And then I started actually, okay, so who is this guy? Because I'd heard his name before. I see a publication list, which is about, probably as big as this board, and it's a very big board. And he's published on chemistry, environmental science, biological science, medical history, books. He's published in BMJ, British Medical Journal. It's like a big journal in medicine. It's quite an extensive list. And, you know, he's probably helped give birth to some of you here, if you were born in Malta. And I'll pass it over to him now. We'll get the show going. So thanks a lot again for coming.
Now my talk comes with a disclaimer. If you injure yourself with anything, as a result of anything I say, it's your responsibility. Right? You're in Kella, don't do this at home. Now we think that sexuality is today's story. And in the olden days, the call was populate or perish. We had to fill up the heavens with as many souls as we possibly could. And we were encouraged to populate or perish. That's the old days. Today, we very often consider that we've changed it to copulate or perish, rather than populate. But I hope that I will leave you with a slight surprise of what actually used to go on in the past. Because fertility has always been there, sexuality has always been there. We've always been concerned, occupied, interested in sex. We wouldn't be here if we weren't. It wouldn't be natural. And if we look at our temple period, that is the fourth, third millennium before Christ, they were very much concerned with sexuality. They developed a whole cult related to fertility. And it wasn't just fertility. They were concerned with sex as well. And if you look at some, these are two statuettes from Malta. That's a lady there, a pregnant lady actually, very clearly telling us her function and how she got pregnant. And the other statuette are two very intimate couple, preserved in clay. These were caught in the act, but these are from Pompeii. As we go on, it's not just temple period. We come to the Semitic period, the Punic period, Punic-Carthaginian period. Again, they were very much concerned with sex. They actually had gods dedicated to sex. The sanctuary at Tassilch was dedicated to Astarte. This is the Punic fertility deity. And eventually, she was equated with the Grecian deity, Aphrodite, by the Greeks, and Venus by the Romans. And so this is just a change in terminology along with the, as the years go by. Eventually also, Tassilch was dedicated to Hera, the Grecian deity Hera. And according to Ptolemy, at least, tells us that it was, that site was dedicated to Hera. And again, Cicero tells us, dedicated to the Roman deity Juno. And these are, again, female deities that relate to marriage and maternity, all sexually related. That's the Venus found at Rabat. It's the 3rd century before Christ, Venus from Malta. Then the Romans came by. And the Romans were concerned with sexuality as well. They did have prostitutes, and actually, the Codex Justinus, this is again in the Byzantine period, so it's 500 and the 6th century after Christ, actually defines the status of the child that's born out of wedlock to a prostitute. Now you will only be concerned yourself with this type of individual in society if you had prostitutes in your society. That was a big problem. You don't concern yourself for the single case. Prostitution was an ongoing concern, a good business. You have to remember, though it doesn't relate to Malta, that in when we talk about in Greece, philosopher politicians actually organized prostitution in Athens. He actually promulgated was to organize prostitution as a profession in Athens. And we come to the medieval period, the Dark Ages. And I hate that term, because the Dark Ages are anything but dark. It's dark because we don't know enough about them. But we're slowly getting to know more and more. And in relation to sexuality, the Dark Ages were a mix of fun and pain. Fun and sex, and pain as a result of infection. There we see Dreuer's painting of the syphilitic, the chap infected with syphilis. And in the 13th century, 1231, we have the Liber Augustalis. This was a codex of laws and regulations that was promulgated by Emperor Frederick II. And then actually, he looks at the punishment that's given out, that's meted out to prostitutes and adulterers. And if you look at this, at these regulations, it brings out strongly the sense of honor and shame. The honor of the person wronged and the shame of that person. So for males, if you're caught doing adultery, maybe even prostitution for that matter, but prostitution was usually considered more a female domain. For the male, if he's caught performing adultery, then his property is confiscated, provided he didn't have legitimate children. So if he was married, obviously there wouldn't be adultery, and had children, then he just went off scot-free. For women, they were either given a public flogging, so they're tied up to the stake and flogged, or else had their nose slit. And one of the first plastic surgery that developed was actually reconstruction of the nose as a result of this in many other societies. In the 15th century, things remained the same. So in 1406, we have Johannes Trallillo of Catania was exiled to Malta as a punishment. So from Catania, we have somebody who lives in Catania. From Catania, he was sent to Malta, and his exile was for 5 years originally. And he put his plea, and he provided proof that he had been provoked to kill his wife, who was adulteress. He was strongly provoked to kill his adulterous wife. And as a result of the proof that he brought forward, his term of exile was reduced to 1 to 2 years instead of 5. Nothing about the wife. You can kill your wife if she's an adulterer. A few years later, Francesco Gatto, he caught his concubine, alla fragrante, of all things, with a baptized Jew and others. So this was really, you can imagine, this was really an orgy going on with this baptized Jew and the others. And Mr. Gatto went into a rage and attacked his wife. Probably he attacked the others, ran out probably. And he slit her nostrils and cut away her genitals with a sword. She didn't die. And after that, because the legal process started against him, probably started off by the Jew, he appealed to the Queen, Queen Bianca, for clemency. And one would expect that the queen, being female, would sympathize with the woman. No. She actually granted him the clemency that he asked for and actually stated that the woman did not have the right for recourse to the law. She removed the rights, the legal rights of that woman. That was a very strong sense of honor and shame. I would have expected, in this type of story that, the queen would have sided with the lady. And again, Philippus of Malta, in 1426, got his wife, alla fragrante. Sounds a nice term, that. And he was granted pardon after he killed her. We also have a Casanova, apparently. And we have Michael Farrugia of Zabuch. Michael Farrugia was not the Casanova. The Casanova was noble Peri Johannes de Mazzara. And, Michael Farrugia of Zabuch forgave this nobleman, this is in 1487, the injury that was done to him through adultery, and renounced all further rights to accuse them, his wife and the noble, but mainly the noble. This is one of the notarial documents of the 15th century, describing, how he's renouncing these rights. The noble was quite active, and we have another notarial document where Stephanus Seikel forgave Laurenza, his wife, and the noble for living in concubage during his absence at sea, incidentally sent by the noble on his ship. And Stephanus renounced all his civil and criminal rights for this action. One of the nobles actually was murdered as a result of the sexual attentions he gave to a lady, well, a lady, a woman in Sigiri. So Nikolaus was along with some friends riding his horse or whatever through the area of Sigiri, saw this lovely lady and passed some comments. And the lady rushed into the village. Oh, I've been insulted, I've been attacked, not physically, but I've been attacked. My honor has been shamed because of what was told to me. And the people of the village, the men of the village, rushed out after Nicholas and his friends. But the target was Nicholas. He was eventually cornered and killed. But as I said, it wasn't just fun and games. There was also pain. That's anticipation. Prostitution was a going concern. And if we look at the records of the Santo Spirito Hospital, that's the oldest hospital we have at Rabat, that was started at least by the mid 14th century. But the patients there included a number of unnamed prostitutes. And also the Imdina Cathedral baptismal records that date back to the mid 16th century also record the birth of infants to particularly women labeled as prostitutes in those records. So this was quite a going concern. But it's not all fun and games. There is pain associated with sex. Venereal disease dates back to a very long time. We know that it affected a number of Maltese. If we look at the Halmeliri church excavations, the skeletal excavations, we have a skull that has erosions in the bone, in the parietal bone, these there, which are probably of syphilitic origin, tertiary stage syphilis. We also know that disease was recorded, that it had affected Magnifico, Francesco Ignomis, and a Dominican friar, Giuseppe Scicluna. Both obviously received private treatment. They went to the private sector, not the public health sector. Again, if we look at the Santo Spirito accounts, in 1544, two females were prescribed treatment for venereal disease. When we talk about venereal disease at the stage, usually a mixture of gonorrhea and syphilis. So it's usually a mixture of the two treatments, now through diseases. And again, in 47, a male was treated and another two females. It seems to have been more common in females. The men seemed not to attend so much. And treatment varied. The medical treatment, they included inguenta, vulnaria for lesions, for direct lesions, and ointments made of turpentine and aloes to free the wounds from pus. And we also know how much this treatment cost. It cost 6 stari, 18 grani. Obviously in the public sector, in the private sector probably was more. But then the knights came. This monastic order. This order of warrior priests, if you want. Monks, warrior monks. They brought their courtesans along with them. We don't call them prostitutes anymore. We call them courtesans now, you see, because these are ladies, lady prostitutes. And in 1588, we are told that there are many courtesans and mistresses, among them the most beautiful European women, Italian, Spanish, Greek, Maltese, and Moorish. This became such a problem that Grandmaster Lacassier had to issue an edict banishing all the loose and disordered women from the capital of Valletta. They had either to quit the island, Morocatania, or retire into the villages or hamlets where the knights did not live. So they had to reside in a place which was away from where the knights lived, from where the convent was situated. And, doctors were so familiar, they saw so much venereal disease, that when got the plague, coming to the islands in the late 16th century, they actually first mistook the lesions. That's syphilis. That's the lesion of syphilis. So they mistook the lesions, the initial lesions, initially during that plague, as a venereal disease. We are told what happened, what the situation really was. The knights are more jealous of their courtesans than the Maltese of their wives. If a female pimp, it doesn't say anything about male pimps, but if a female pimp was caught prostituting girls or selling girls, then she was put on a donkey. Her hands were chained in front, and while her feet were chained under her, so she couldn't get off the donkey. And then her back was bared, and she was flogged as she was riding through the streets with a man blowing the trumpet as he's walking by. Then she had a choice to leave. That was the only choice she had. She was exiled from the island. She was asked to put on a ship and exiled from the island. But only female pimps. Male pimps don't come into it. In the 18th century, we have a code of law. It was promulgated under the insistence of De Villena, Grandmaster De Villena. And men of means, sta bene, who frequented prostitutes, were liable to a fine. This will fill up our coffers. In the first two instances, we'll fill up our coffers twice. And then, after that, they're too much trouble, we've had their tax, and we banish them from the island if they had more subsequent offenses. Those who could not pay their fines were punished by whipping in the first instance, and for later offenses, they were given employment by the order, a period of hard labor, usually on their ships, as oarsmen on their ships. The females, the prostitutes, were left to the discretion of the Grand Master what to do with them. The next set of laws was those of Deroan. And here, foreign courtesans were barred from entering the country. So if you come with a label saying, I'm a prostitute, or occupation, prostitute, you're not allowed to land. And, since we couldn't quite do this to the Maltese that were born here, they were prohibited from opening their doors between sunset and sunrise. So if you go in there before sunset, she can do whatever. She cannot open her doors before sunset and sunrise. So it's either a whole night affair or nothing at all. And she couldn't go to the taverns and inns. But if you knew her address, if you had her card, you could easily arrange an appointment with her. The other thing that was introduced, which is interesting, is the periodic examination of prostitutes by the physicians to make sure that they had a clean bill of health. They were certified as healthy. I've seen some of these books. They still exist, of the 19th century, not during the knights, it's the British period, because that was maintained. And you get the names, and healthy, infected. Now, venereal disease continued. Not only continued, but we're told the Maltese form of syphilis was particularly virulent. And in 1679, we're told there's no place in the whole world where venereal disease attacks faster and spread easier than in Malta. For here it's a mixture of all the diseases. And this became such a problem, and the treatment became such a problem, they had to develop special hospitals, the Falanga. The Falanga was the order, the Council of the Order of St. John in 1596, we're discussing where to put up this permanent place for the treatment of venereal disease, the Morbo Gallo. And initially it was set close to the Casetta delle Donne. The Casetta delle Donne was a hospital that's situated where his labs is. You know, they have his buildings. These were laboratories. Those were before the laboratories, before the Second World War. That was the female hospital. So this was a small ward building there. But it wasn't enough. The building they arranged, the space they arranged wasn't enough. And they had to set up a ward in the Sagra Infermeria to replace the old Falanga. And this was an annex to the Great Ward. It's on the in the far end of the of Knights Hall. It's on the far end. It had rooms where treatment was given, and treatment was mercury, very poisonous. And it was given for both sexes, and it was also provided with hotel rooms, some type of sauna. And they were managed by particular individuals, these two fellow, or steam bath attendant. In 1787, the total number of patients treated was 256. That included 193 foreigners. In 87, it went down. If they had their public health officials with statistics, they would have rubbed their hands. We don't know what happened after this year after it went up. But it had gone down to 193 and 160 foreigners. All the patients were examined by the principal surgeon, the principal physician, and then if they were diagnosed as having gonorrhea, which is one type of venereal disease, they were treated as an outpatient on an outpatient's basis. But if a man presented himself and was found to have infection, he was not treated until his wife was brought over. So good principles of follow-up, extended follow-up. Obviously, if he didn't get it from his wife, then the prostitute should have been treated. But I doubt that he would have said so. And there was a special female attendant called the spalmante, or spalmatoria. And she was particularly employed to look after patients undergoing mercurial treatment. Or else it was given by convicts or Christian slaves, who were paid on a daily basis. Now, mercury is a dangerous chemical. It's a neurotoxin. And in 1786, we have the first case of occupational disease. Because the spalmante, Anna Maria Alexi, petitioned the order that her job, she wanted that her job was transferred to her daughter. Because her hands had become so contracted, she didn't know it was because of the mercury, but her hands had become so contracted that she could no longer administer the treatment. And obviously she was going to be replaced. So if she was going to be replaced, can my daughter have my job? Now the British came. The British maintained this concept of periodic examination of prostitutes. And in 1830, they were seeing more than 160 women a month. Good business, eh? Though the majority were in Valletta. So it was a good business. Now these were examined in a street, in a building in Strada Tramontana, North Street. North Street is Evans, is the street across, public street. And their problems used to occur. Because as the women were going in, there was a queue of men where the women came out. So the woman went in, got checked, declared free of disease, because she came out, and the men were waiting. And obviously, problems occurred, because somebody wanted to go with one girl, the other wanted to go with another. So they had to transfer those clinics and put them back to the venereal wards of the Caseta. And they had actually to place a sentry there to push away the suitors. Now, in 1859, the prostitutes realized that this periodic examination had no legal basis. So they stopped presenting themselves. obviously the government of the day, 2 years later in 1861, enacted and legally re-established the compulsory periodic examinations of prostitutes. They used to be given a tag. I've seen some of these tags. Whatever employment you had, you received a tag. So if you are a boatswain, you received a tag. If you sold water, you had a tag. And prostitutes had their own tag. In one of our census reports, the prostitute population in Malta numbered 120. Those are women who gave the prostitution as their occupation. Now, a suggestion was made in 1888 to withdraw this ordinance. But the local population especially were not particularly pleased with this, and we find in the public opinion of 1888, and its newspaper, that there's no reason why this island should be converted into a pest house for the propagation of the foulest and most insidious disease. They had quite a good concept, because it undermines, venereal disease undermines not only the health of the individual who's affected by it, but also of innocent generations yet unborn. So they had the concept of congenital, that it actually affects the unborn fetus. And the ordinance was maintained. It was re-enacted in 1920 as the Venereal Disease Ordinance, confirmed in 1930. It was repealed in 1931, but at the onset of the Second World War, it was re-established and became a criminal offense to knowingly transmit a sexually transmitted disease. If you know you have any disease that's transmitted by sex, it is illegal. It's a criminal act to have intercourse with somebody without informing them. And also to engage in occupations that can transmit that disease. So if you're infected, if you have HIV, for instance, if you take the modern times, you cannot become a prostitute. And eventually also the regulations were extended and the compulsory treatment was enforced. If you had infection, if somebody was proven to have infection, then he had to receive treatment by law. We also have lock hospitals being developed. Lock hospitals, again, were hospitals dedicated to sexually transmitted disease. And we see these a whole hospital being organized during the French period. You know that the French were in the Valletta region, Valletta and Cotonera region, and they were eventually encircled there by the Maltese and the British. And they had actually to set up a ward, because most of the soldiers, a large number of soldiers, got infected with syphilis. So the Anglo-Bavarian Auberge at Valletta was changed into a lock hospital. Actually, there's a good story during the French period where Vabois decided that enough is enough. I can't have my soldiers becoming sick with venereal disease. So he took all the loose women, what he called loose women, women who did not have a partner in Valletta and the fortified cities, and threw them up, let them infect the Maltese, but at least I'll keep my soldiers healthy. And that was one of the first types of biological warfare. Now in 1861, the British felt the need to really set up a lock hospital, because the Anglo-Bavarian Auberge was closed down, and this was set up as a detached pavilion in the civil hospital at Floriana. Had two closely supervised wards. They had to be closely supervised. If one ward had females and the other males who had sexually transmitted disease. And it accommodated 30 patients. They continued to function there until they went to the SVPH, to the poor house at Imgire, which is basically the SVPH today in 1910. And there that had 10 beds and functioned until 1930. A clinic was set up in the hospital in 1926. And we also have the statistics. The British period, we have a lot of statistics for the British period, and we know that in 1919, they saw 83 cases. In 1920, after the ordinance was promulgated for, you know, legal requirement to treat, then we got 138 cases, and it remained the same more or less during the 20s, the early 20s. And they saw a wide variety of disease. They saw gonorrhea, chancroid, syphilis, Bartholinitis, and also, we know, during that period, 3 cases of insanity, because syphilis causes general paralysis of the insane, which is why we don't have so many insane anymore up at Mount Carmel. They're all out, out on the streets. But the terminal stage, one of the terminal forms of syphilis is GPI, general paralysis of the insane. And in that year, 3 cases of insanity were attributed to GPI. And the outpatients, in 1937, it dealt with 159 males and 71 females. And there you can see more or less the pattern of disease that was the common disease, syphilis and gonorrhea, over the years. But again, there was a wide variety, syphilis, gonorrhea, chancroid, vulvovaginitis, condylomata, and balanoprostysis. And the treatment, again, wasn't much advanced as in the past. For syphilis, the treatment was based on arsenic, bismuth, and mercury, very nasty chemicals. Gonorrhea was treated by local management, irrigations, that sort of things. But antibiotics were introduced in the 1930s, around 1935, and that they were found to be very useful. Then when penicillin was introduced, again, this was found to be very useful in the management. Well, that's the British period. Let's come to the modern period. Are we any different? Well, we are different, aren't we? We're Roman Catholic, very strong Roman Catholic environment. We're all goodies. Yes, we are, compared to Europe. Maltese do have less sexual partners than in Europe. And so if we have to see the mean of males, it's about 6.3. The mean of females is 5.3, compared to Europe, 7.5 and 6.3. So, yes, we do have less sexual partners. Having said that, 73% of males and 45% of females, when interviewed, this is an interview of 200 people of both sexes, had more than 5 partners. Why the sexual liberation? Why have we become sexually liberated? Basically, I think one is the availability of contraception. It's liberated the tie between having babies, if you use it, and sex, and the pleasure of sex. I think also there's this instant gratification syndrome, what I call it the instant gratification syndrome. I want things now, and now, irrespective of the consequences. And, look, the media is all about instant gratification. Buy that, now. You'll enjoy it. Buy that car, it's a beautiful car, go buy it. Now. Can you afford it? It doesn't matter, you can, go buy it. So that's instant gratification mentality. It's commercialism. We've commercialized a very intimate part of our life. The other thing is the change in moral norms. Today's generation is not my generation. The way we think is different. Moral norms have changed, rightly or wrongly, but they are different. Now, if we look at contraception, I said, one of the things that liberated sexuality is contraception. We look at contraception and family size. You can see in the 19th century, if you take the mean parity by age of women in the 19th century, it just kept going up, up, up. It was natural. That's the natural pattern of things. If you look in the 1980s, which is the 20th century, then you can see a controlled pattern going up in the 1980s, about 2 to 3 children. So there's this concept of planned parenthood. Contraception, the use of contraception has changed. Now we have 3 surveys about contraceptive use. In 1971, one sees that we were using coitus interruptus. 70% of women were using coitus interruptus. but by last year, only about 22 were using coitus interruptus. Withdrawal. Reverse. Abstinence or the rhythm method, 40%, 41%, to about 22. You see that condom use has gone up. The effective methods of contraception have gone up over these last
more or less four decades. Okay, so
hormonal has gone up, sterilization has gone up, and contraception, diaphragm, we don't really use the diaphragm, the condom has gone up as well. Now, is that reassuring? Not really. Because we had to ask these 200 people, asking them about the first time they had sex and whether they used contraception, 62% said no. They used absolutely no method of contraception, which is much higher than that in Europe. Even in Europe, they don't do too well, because it's 47% in around European countries. But we have the highest, actually, non-contraceptive use for first intercourse. And this reflects in out-of-wedlock maternities. Now, there are a lot of reasons why we have out-of-wedlock maternities. Some of them are social. It's the social welfare state that's promoting it.
Yeah, but if you look at, if you look in the 60s until the 90s,
it was less than 2% of women had babies out of wedlock. Now it's gone up close to 30%, 25-30%. So we're talking at least 1/4 of our births are out of wedlock. And this very often occurs in the young. So if we take a comparison, this is a study we did, we take a comparison of births in wedlock and out of wedlock, you find that the age distribution is more likely to occur out of wedlock, the white bars, in the younger generation than in the older. Now, at what stage do we have sex? Our community is having sex? And again, we tend to be later on averages. Males will have sex around 18.4, 18 and a half years as a mean, compared to Europe, that's higher, and females, 19 years, which is again higher than in Europe. But having said that, 22% of boys and 13% of girls had their first sexual encounter by the age of 15 years. So quite a good proportion are actually having early sex. It creates problems. Creates problems, one, in the number of maternities, number of births that occur in the younger generation. Now, one has to appreciate that having a baby when you're studying does have an effect on your future life. You need a lot of support. Otherwise, you stop studying. But you can see here the rate percent of deliveries of women under 20 years. And it keeps, every year, it keeps going up and up and up. So in 2009, there were about over 6.7% of maternities in women under the age of 20. The pattern is similar, but obviously at a lower percentage, if you take women under the age of 17. Is this because we don't have abortion in Malta? Actually, we do. There are statistics that tell us the number of terminations that occur in the UK annually. The British keep very good statistics. They tell us how many abortions are done in Maltese individuals. This is just the UK. There's a good proportion that go to Italy and also to other European countries. Strange, I was surprised last week to hear of a couple of cases that went to Sweden for a termination by the Swedish doctor, actually. I was at a meeting. And these are basically the rates of termination per 100 total births. It's quite high. The red bars there show you the number of births that we lose as a result of a disease process. So the red bars are those, the rates of infants that are either born dead or die in the first peak of life.
You can see that it's always, I don't know what happened here, probably they went to Sicily. But, you know, the rates are about a half to a third lower of natural deaths than terminations.
What about sexually transmitted disease? Now, unfortunately, there we don't have much in the way of incident statistics, because until 2004, it was not considered right to collect the statistic, because you have to report the individual. So before data, you know, it was not considered quite right. But after 2004, actually, these statistics started being collected. Now we have data about AIDS and HIV. But if you look chlamydia, chlamydia is an infection that affects both males and females, but in females, it is one of the major causes of infertility. Because once you get an infection, a chlamydia infection, then the tubes get blocked. And, you know, if you look at the number of cases of chlamydia, it's going up. If you look at gonorrhea, gonorrhea is the same situation. It affects males a bit more, because it gives burning, pishikalda, gives burning urine, hot urine. But in females, it damages the tube as well. So it's again, it's a major cause, one of our causes of infertility. And again, it's going up. Syphilis, with all its stages, giving rise to very, in the tertiary stage, after years and years of having it, unknowingly, giving rise to very severe lesions, and can give aortic aneurysms, where the aorta simply weakens, the wall, and bursts. There's a nice painting of an aortic aneurysm by Mattia Preti at Vittoriosa in the church museum in the oratory at Vittoriosa. You can see this Saint Jerome hitting his chest, and he's got this aortic aneurysm, probably with syphilitic gammata around it. So, you know, the sitter actually had syphilis. And so his picture, the Saint Jerome. But it can give you insanity, general paralysis of the insane. And again, it's going up. So wherever we look, sexually transmitted disease is increasing. And the consequences, as I said, one of them is infertility. And if we look at the percentage of maternities that that are achieved by going for artificial methods. Now we have all this debate about IVF, ICSI, these techniques. They again are quite significant. They vary because our numbers are low, our denominator is low, but they're there. And one has to appreciate that these techniques do carry problems for the unborn child. Children. Very often, the majority of these are twins or even higher order. I've had the misfortune, I would say, not rather than opportunity, of seeing an octopregnancy. 8 babies at once. She lost them all. So, you know, they do carry consequences. Even having to resort to these methods as a result of sexually transmitted disease, having to resort to these methods does carry its consequences for the child, besides the mother, because even the treatment itself can kill the mother. But sex can kill you. Sex can very much kill you, because cervical cancer is a sexually transmitted disease. In my day, everything, we went through a lot of causes. The etiology of cervical cancer went through everything. But in the 80s, we started realizing that it is related to an HPV infection, human papilloma virus. The virus that gives rise to warts. And these are the cancer statistics, which we go back, our cancer statistics go back to the 1960s, but concentrated here for the last 50 years or so. You can see that, yes, cervical cancer has gone down, it went up in the last lot. Whether that is significant or not, one has to see. But yes, cervical cancer has gone down, but the precancerous lesions have gone up. And that is basically because more and more women are coming to do cervical screening, the famous smear test. Mortality has more or less remained the same. The proportion of women dying from cervical cancer has remained more or less the same, which means that the women who really need it are not coming for screening or coming too late. This is something about the HPV virus. There are loads of HPV viruses. Affects the whole animal kingdom. But in the human, again, there are loads of types. And not all of them give rise to cervical cancer. So we have two groups that give to cervical cancer, HPV 18, type 18, and along with HPV 45, and related to it, and HPV 16, and related to 31. And there are others that give rise to cervical cancer. But it can give rise to genital warts, which are very uncomfortable sometimes and terrible to treat, foot warts or hand warts. Now again, we have no incidence statistics about warts, genital warts, or cervical HPV, and we can only make guesstimates from the data that we collect. But if we take HPV infection, genital infection, where at least 40 per 100,000 of the population have this infection, at least. And these are those that are reported from the GU clinic in the population. We take cervical cytology on smear test, about 60% or 60 per 100,000 have an abnormality. So it's a very common common abnormality. These are the various types of HPV that can give rise to cervical cancer. The commonest are 16 and 18. Those account for about 70% of all cervical cancers. And we can prevent it. We can prevent it in a number of ways. One, we can have no sex. Or if you're going to have sex, use a condom. It gives an element of protection. It doesn't give full protection. It gives an element of protection. So no sex. Stay with one partner. Never have more than one partner unless it's been around. Because if it's been around, then it's like having group sex. Sex is fun. I mean, if your partner has gone around with three other women, and those three other women have gone around with six other men, and those six other men have gone around, and every time you have intercourse, you can imagine the multiplication factor. So it is group sex. Condom use, and now we have the vaccines, which is something that we should very much push our politicians to introduce. And unfortunately, they're still expensive, though the price is coming down. But it is an effective way, they are an effective way of preventing cervical cancer. The other thing is secondary prevention. And secondary prevention is management, I forgot the T there, but secondary management is through the cervical screening. And even if we introduce vaccination, we still have to continue, because vaccination will only cover against 16 and 18 types. A bit of cover for the others, but for 16 and 18, with regards to cervical cancer. So there'll be other types. So cervical screening still needs to be done. And a large number, 36% of women in the last health survey told us that she never had a smear test done. So we don't have a national program. It's an opportunistic program. And, more than a third actually don't do it. They've never had it done. It's not a question of doing it and then not repeating it some other time. Those are other reasons for failing, for the system failing. But more than a third have never had it done. We have to remember, as Robin Williams told us, that the problem is that God gave man a brain and a penis, but only enough blood to run one at a time. And finally, we have to balance things. Our society tries to balance things between 101 positions and 102 excuses, headaches, and also the irony of a president of a country, the United States, who was nearly brought down because of a sex scandal, when so much sexual misconduct is being carried around us. And that's the end of my talk.
Thank you, Professor Savona, for that really interesting talk. Now we come to what I think is the most exciting part of the event, which is just, you can ask me whatever you want. So instead of me blabbing blah, 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 I'll let you ask him any question on sex. So, right?
Yeah.
Cool.
Let me start. My advice to the ones that are above the age of 40, don't try any new positions. Because you will get a slip disc. Yeah? You still will get a slip disc. Probably the best way is lie back and enjoy it.
I was just curious to know that in those charts where the birth rate went down, if we could differentiate between whether they're using contraception or because they're sterile with some kind of sexual disease.
Which birth rates have gone down? Because the under 20s have gone up. The under 20s proportion have gone up.
Yes.
Our birth rate in general has gone down. In fact, we have a problem in Malta because we are below the replaceability factor. Our fertility rate is below the replaceability factor. So we will become extinct as Maltese.
But this is what I'm asking, whether it is because of fertility problems or use of contraception.
I think it's mainly, well, infertility has increased. I've been practicing, you know, my specialty, which is obstetrics and gynecology, for the last 30 years. Giving you an idea of my age. And definitely, the problems we see with infertility have definitely increased, both in male and female infertility. I'm surprised, I'm actually fascinated by the fact that, you know, the number of male infertile male I see are much more problems with fertility in male, are much more than I used to see in the past. Now, whether it's because people did not seek attention in the past or not, but you know, this is the impression. Right? It's nothing statistical. Contraception has increased, and effective contraception has increased. So definitely, that has contributed to the fall in fertility. So you know, probably it's a mixture of both. But I think the main reason why our fertility rate overall has gone down—it's about 1.4, which is why it's not replaceable. Why it has gone down is basically because women and families don't want kids, more than two kids. Next to us do, because very often I get patients now, you know, one is enough. Sometimes even they don't consider children. There are social factors that come into this, and because the fact that now women are getting better educated than they were 40 years ago. A larger proportion of women are going into university seeking a career than they did 40 years ago. And so, you know, the social situation has changed completely. 40 years ago, if you were employed with government or a parastatal body, you stopped working once you got married. So the scope was to increase employment at least in one member of the family. Positive discrimination to male employment. So, you know, there have been these social movements. Today, women take longer to educate themselves. They seek a career, they follow a career, which sometimes becomes more and more difficult. I see this in our trainees. And then they come to a stage where, hey, it's basically now or never. And then they only have time for one child, because how can you cope? You know, it becomes more difficult to cope. It's difficult to cope with one child when you're working. When the couple are working, and it's become a necessity economically now for a couple to work, then if you have two children, it's going to be even worse. The problems are going to be even worse.
Hi. Since big part of the lecture focused on the history of sex and how it evolved and practices basically changed in time, one cannot miss out on the fact that the main factor that we talked about today, sex, was constantly being linked to something else, which was the practice of religion. And in time, there was in ancient history, they used to pray to gods maybe for increased fertility or this and that. And I'm not sure if that relationship between sex and religion is still prevailing so much today. Is religion still influencing our sexual behavior or what we should aspire to? Or
I think sex has become a religion. I think sex has become a religion in itself.
Okay.
People follow a religion that pertains to sex. We have people in our society who adore the sex god. Not the fertility god, because fertility is something different. You look at fertility in the Neolithic period, what we call the Neolithic period, because it was the Copper Age period, actually, and the Temple period, which is a better term. If you look at fertility there, fertility was not simply fertility of humanity. That was important, because the bigger the family, look at the Old Testament, the bigger the family, Abraham, his concept with a large family. Why? Because large family meant power, wealth. You had people to mind your crops, mind your sheep, because there were nomads, so you had more wealth. So human fertility was wealth. But that did not really relate to survival. And our fertility goddess was a fertility goddess that related to survival. You asked your god, because the fertility goddess, in the concept of fertility as the female, fat female form, which incidentally is usually infertile, but you asked the fertility goddess to give you good crops, to give you good husbandry. If you go to the temple sites, what do you find there? You find friezes that show the sheep, the mufflon, the primitive sheep, the ibex, primitive goat, and the hog, the wild hog. You find remains of cattle. You find remains of grain. You find remains of seashells. At Bujibba, you find remains of the sargu, friezes of the fish, because that is a fishing that was a fishing community. So they were giving back to their fertility goddess what the goddess was giving back to them. And we find this again in the Old Testament. This is what was happening in the Old Testament. You had your sheep, you had your cattle, you chose the best one and sacrificed it to God. The same concept, this concept of, a God, a caring God that takes care of you. This is the relation of fertility in those days. So a God that takes care of you, keeping you alive, not letting you get hungry and increasing your wealth by increasing the family. Today it's different. Come back today. And this was different throughout the ages. Once you come to the classical period, then you start getting goddesses, deities, that had a different meaning. It was sex at its basest. And you get temples related to them, whatever. The silt, for instance. And this is sex, pure sex. The fun of sex. In the medieval period, yes, there was religion around. So this is the sense of honor and shame. Possibly, because it could be simply, a hurt pride. But there's this, along with that religion that was going on, then you get people undergoing the fun of sex. But along with the fun comes the pain. I think now we have a community within the larger community that has nothing, they have their own religion. You get patients who come and say, why didn't you use contraception when you got pregnant? I never knew I was having sex.
Where do you see Maltese sexual practices and sexuality going in the future?
Downhill? Well, it depends on one's points of view. Because, my morals are different from other people's morals, and everything is relative to what one believes in. But definitely, if we do not have a major sociological and mental change on the island, we're going to have loads of problems. If we're going down the road for free sexuality, then we need to take the right precautions. Otherwise, our society will suffer. It will suffer on an individual level. Infertility is no fun. And when a couple want children and they are infertile as a result of their sexual habits, not to say promiscuity, but sexual habits, then it's a pitiful situation. And also the long-term effects, because syphilis is increasing. I mean, we went through a phase. Syphilis is something that we screen every woman for when they get pregnant, because it can affect the unborn child. So we have to know that it's there, so that we treat, to prevent the effects on the child. But we went through a phase where syphilis was non-existent on the island. So we stopped screening. But it started going up, and it is still rising. Yeah. At one time, we see this pattern changes. When I started off, I used to see more gonorrhea than I see chlamydia. Now I see more chlamydia than I see gonorrhea. And so the patterns change. And it's all the, you know, we have diseases from Eastern Europe, from the Maghreb countries. They keep changing our pattern of disease. But their effects are there, and they're increasing.
How do they treat syphilis today?
It's antibiotics, once you diagnose it. Well, you give a course of antibiotics. It's very simple to treat syphilis today, unlike in the past where, you know, you used to poison them. I was told there was the anesthetist here, a colleague, and he reminded me of a statement: 5 minutes with Venus and a lifetime with Mercury.
In your historical account, prostitution was always seemed to be looked down upon by the governing bodies in whatever period. At the same time, there was legalized obligation to medically assess prostitutes for lack of infection. How do these two apparently contradicting events corroborate each other? I mean, it's the same governing institution which at one point says this is illegal. Yeah. And you can't do it. And they say, but
I mean, it's being pragmatic. I mean, I have a problem. It's not going to go away. Prostitution is there. It's been there. It will remain there. With whatever form. I mean, that takes various forms. It's there. It's harmful health-wise to the community. So at least let's try to control the harm. If we can't control people not for going with prostitutes and try to get rid of the prostitutes, then at least let us control the harm. And so we control the harm that's brought on by STDs, sexually transmitted disease. A manager has to be pragmatic. This is what you have. This is the situation. We have to do something about it.
Just a question. What about male prostitution, past and present?
It was always, that is never comes out. Because that is even worse than female prostitution. Sodomy. Sodom and Gomorrah. So it was always, that's even worse. But there's some work that's been done and published, actually, on the history of homosexuality. And, you know, a bit of mention on abuse of young males, for instance. I've never really looked into it myself. But people have written up some things about it, especially in relation to the knights. Because it was illegal for a knight to do it, to have sodomy. And it's part of the regulations of the Knights of the Order, of the Order of St. John, that it is, you know, this is something that kicked you out of the order.
I've heard something about Spiteri, people who were called Spiteri coming Spiteri. From...
The Spiteri were children that were abandoned for whatever reason in Santo Spirito. They were brought up in Santo Spirito, sometimes by fostering, sometimes they were given up for adoption, but usually through fostering. And they Santo Spirito used also to employ wet nurses to breastfeed them. And there are some cases, very moving cases, where the wet nurse became so attached to her, you know,
to her baby that eventually she applied for her to foster the child and keep it. Usually they have their own child as well when they're breastfeeding. And then they, very often they were employed in Santo Spirito. They stayed there and they took part and they helped manage the place. And you will get references to nurses or attendants in Santo Spirito being referred to as spitalieri. So this is where the spiteri comes from. So spiteri is a mixed genetic
I thought it
food.
Was something to do with the knights, with the offspring of
this
the knights.
This was before the knights, actually. Oh, okay. You know. This was before the knights. Oh, the offspring of the knights gave rise to us. The Ventura I know of was a knight of St. John. I don't know whether it was a relationship. I wish it was, because they have vineyards off. This family have vineyards off in Spain, just off Spain. But they were Portuguese, actually. So I wouldn't mind being a relationship to them. One day I want to email them, say, look, I think I'm in a relationship. All I want is a crate of your wine, which is very good wine. Okay? It's called Ventura wine. They don't have a large vineyard. So if they send me a crate, then it would be fine every year. But, you know, if you take the despot, the direct line to grandmaster, that's big. You know, so a lot of us have, you know, there's all, you know, there were excuses for it, but.
Okay, we're shifting from a society where sex is behind closed doors to sex is open. We're still getting unwanted pregnancies. Young girls having babies, something is wrong, something is missing with information readily available, or is it? What's happening?
I think it depends very much on the education and the emphasis we give to sexuality in education. We start education, compared to Europe, our education system is good. It starts. And if you take that survey of 100 males, 100 females, so it's not a big survey, but if you look at the data there and see where they got information about sex and contraception, a good proportion, a very significant proportion compared to Europe said the schools. So schools are doing something. What happens very often is the attitude, it won't happen to me. If a female carries a condom in her purse,
there is something wrong. The message is not
it's a mixed message. It's a mixed message that society is giving
them.
There is
an imbalance.
It's the society about them is giving them a mixed message. We're not getting the right message through. Sex should be something. No, the message should be: sex is a responsible act. If you're going to have sex, then you have to have responsible sex. This is not what's happening. At least that's my viewpoint. It's not happening.
To talk about education at schools in Malta, I don't know. I think it's a disaster, because I wouldn't trust that statistics, because I never had sex education at school. Maybe at most it would be because it was an all-boys school and boys will talk about it, you know. But considering Malta, as far as I know, Malta doesn't have a sexual health bill.
No, it doesn't.
Which I think is
a sexual health policy.
Is a crime in itself. You know, we should. I think that's one of the reasons why we have such a high teenage pregnancy rate, is that we don't have proper education at schools. You know, we need to press it on to, you know.
No, definitely. I think we have to change the emphasis of the education they're getting. You see, it's not a question of mentioning. This is like once the WHO went to teach contraception to one of these primitive tribes, I think somewhere in Papua New Guinea. And they were telling them about the condom. They took the bamboo stick and showed them how to put on the condom and put it all, whatever. And they left them a good supply of condoms. But nothing happened to their fertility rate. It remained the same. And they realized that, yes, they were using the condoms on the bamboo stick, putting it outside the door of their hut.
PhD syllabus is statutory, and you have to govern. I mean, there's Marcette here, who's a PhD teacher, and she can actually say what's been done at school. But we have two problems. One is what Prof. Ventura said, it will never happen to me. And that's one. And number two, PhD can't only be a timetable subject. It has to be a whole school approach. And also, which is very important, the media and the business people have to get their act going and become responsible. Because we are having children in Portugal underage being given drinks. And that leads to promiscuity. And I think that the legal system and the industry have to be responsible. I mean, people can see that this boy isn't over 18, so why is he being given drink? And that is leading. So I think we are doing, but we're only a drop in the ocean if it's not a collaborated effort with the media, the legal, and the business people. And I feel strongly about this.
I'd like to go back a bit to the historical part. I believe, I may be wrong, but I understand that sexual offences, including homosexual offences, were the main accusations levelled at the Knights Templar in order to justify their forced disbandment, or one of the main accusations. And there are sort of pros and cons, not pros and cons, there are beliefs and whether this was actually real or unreal, or whether it was sort of constructed in order to disband them for other reasons. Do you have any opinion on this? I mean,
well,
I hope I haven't touched on that very.
No, the Knights Templar. The Knights Templar were disbanded for political reasons, basically political and financial reasons. The Philip le Bel, the King of France, had this army of professional soldiers who were not under his control. He had this enormous international bank to which he was indebted. He had the Pope in his pocket, because he had actually helped elect the Pope by discrediting the previous Pope with similar accusations, actually. And he used the same techniques to disband the Knights Templar. Now, were the Knights Templar sodomists? Well, they were accused of being so. Were they worshipping the devil, Bahomet? They were accused as doing so. Did they? Did all the Knights Templar do that? Was it part of the ritual of becoming a Knights Templar? I think history will never really tell us. All we know is that the Pope, Pope Clement, if I remember correctly, has left a document in the Vatican archives, which was recently, in the last years, discovered, where he actually states that the Knights Templar were innocent. So, the truth will prevail. Definitely, in the regulations that we have of the order, I don't know about the Knights, there are the regulations of the Knights Templar. I don't think, I don't remember seeing sodomy as being being against sodomy. I don't remember the regulation of the Knights Templar. But definitely in the regulations of the Order of St. John, sodomy was one reason why you were kicked out of the order and punished, defrogged. So, and very often the regulations of these orders, since they date back to their origins in the Holy Land, were very similar. So the regulations of the Knights Templar were relatively similar to those of the Order of St. John. After all, they were written by St. Bernard. Those of St. Lazarus were similar. It's just that the scope of their actions were different. The Knights Templar were warriors, eventually bankers. The others were hoteliers, eventually hospitallers and warriors. So I don't believe that that was a true accusation, personally, but I wasn't there.
I would like to reply to the previous question about kids not being educated about sex. First of all, I'm a science teacher, so I deal more with the mechanical side of the issue, but anyway. First thing I'd like to say is that kids have a great taste for learning the stuff, but when I tell them, right, you can ask any question you want.
Really?
Oh, okay, yes. And then they sort of ask the questions they like, they listen to what they want to know. Sometimes, of course, they won't listen to what they need to know. And unfortunately, when, at the stage that they learn it, they're a bit too young to assimilate what's been learned. And then later on, it's taken for granted, sort of, yeah, okay, yeah, now they know it, sort of, and we stop telling them these things. At least, unless you take biology and science, at least, we do it in Form 1, and then we stop there.
I think you're right, actually, that that's education has to be a progressive, continuous process.
So as they want to learn, and they're really interested. I had kids studying for the first time in their life, and people going to the library for the first time in their life, I guess, just to learn about sex, but then...
Yeah, but the problem is, I think, that, one, in Form 4 and Form 5, we are concentrating on the academic... a lot on the academic side of things, because they have to pass their exams. Once they finish that, and they are in, how old are they in Form 4, Form 5?
15.
So they are in their early teens. We still get problems in the early teens, but it's a small minority, but we still get problems in the early teens. But I think the concept of education has to be ongoing. So we have to have programs in secondary school. Oh, sorry, post-secondary school. It has to go on in some form or another. But it has to be an ongoing process. And sometimes even medical students need to have an ongoing process. And young doctors. So they know about contraception. I give them the lecture on contraception, so they know about contraception. I mean, my kids went to a mixed school, so I can't really say, I don't have any experiences or personal experiences of children who have been in segregated schools, so I can't really tell. But definitely, I think, having contact with the opposite sex at an early age on a non-sexual level is important, because one can deal with issues better, I think. That's why it has to be a wide range, you see? You cannot say, you know, I'm going to start teaching about sexuality in schools at the age of 14, because some will be, that might teach them everything at 14. But you have to build it up and be progressive. And it's not just the schools. We're mentioning schools, but it's the home as well. But I find that there's, you know, there's still this resistance for parents to teach the kids about sex. They feel uncomfortable. And why do they feel uncomfortable? Because they've always been made to feel uncomfortable. Hopefully, yeah, it's taboo. Yeah? I mean, you know, you get mothers who bring their children, teenagers. What they want is to put them on the pill. They don't tell you that. It goes such a roundabout fashion, because they don't want to say, oh, I want her to be on the pill. They go in a roundabout fashion to give, find an excuse why to start the contraceptive pill. Because back of their mind, at least she can get sexually transmitted disease. Because she can still get sexually transmitted disease. The pill does not prevent sexually transmitted disease. No? But at least that's a worry of their mind, because this is the main thing that was worrying.
I'm moving away a bit from this angle. One thing that I think is a rising problem is that when someone goes to apply for a home loan, you have to get an insurance. And the insurance forms usually include this new question: have you had unprotected sex? Now, if you have a very honest gay who would say yes, then the insurance premium suddenly goes sky high. And then you might have someone who might have, you know, been doing everything, fooling around, and she would lie or he would lie, and it's caught free, which I think is very, very unfair. So I think this should be looked at some point.
I mean, insurances are private agencies. It's true that if you have some sexually transmitted disease, particularly HIV, then if you take life, if you're looking at life problems, lifelong problems, and the early termination of life, basically, they're higher.
Yes, yes.
I can imagine that somebody who has gotten who is HIV positive is that as a risk to the insurance. Now, how do you identify people who are HIV positive? Well, I think the best way to do it would be for the insurance to ask for a test.
They do.
And then repeat the test a few months later because you can still be negative and infected.
Yes, yes. But can I just introduce a bit of humor here?
A bit of course.
So there was this prostitute who went to apply at the employment agency. And he said, "What's your profession?" And she said, "Prostitute." And he said, "No, I'm sorry, I can't write that down. Can you give me another name, label?" And she said, "Fine." She said, "Escort service?" And he said, "No, that's unacceptable too." So she had a little think, and she said, "I know." She said, "I'm a chicken farmer." He said, "Chicken farmer? What has that got to do?" She said, "I raised 1,000 cocks last year."
She has to be careful, eh? Because the tax department will get to her with that answer. Torosh vet receipt.
So maybe it's time to just wrap things up and give a good round of applause to Professor. All right, now we host these on a monthly basis. So the next one's going to be on the 16th June, and it's going to be Professor Pierre Schembri-Wismar. And the topic is going to be either on stem cells or cancer. It depends whoever goes on Facebook, because we're on Facebook, and says whether they want cancer or stem cells. And I'll go with whatever you guys send me to. So thanks again for coming, and hope to see you again. Thanks again.
You have just listened to a talk organized by Malta Café Scientifique entitled Sex and the City. This talk was delivered by Professor Savona Ventura.